Hello, welcome to the House of Comments podcast. This is a special summer edition of the podcast where we're doing something a little bit different and we're having interviews with particular people that we've invited on. So we're trying to avoid topical stuff because I'll let you into a little secret. We recorded this early so we could go away and have a nice holiday. So I'm delighted to be joined today by Ian Collins, who is a presenter on LBC 97.3. I've been a guest on his show a few times. And also he is a member of the parliamentary lobby as well. So good afternoon, Ian.
Afternoon, Mark. And thank you for the pina colada as well, just to give it that summer feel. Which was, very nice of you.
It is actually baking hot at the moment. I've just gone down to Tesco's and bought what I thought was an air conditioning unit, but I think is an air cooler, which is something a bit different. It's not cooling very well at the moment. But
do they sell air conditioning units in Tesco's?
I thought they would. In the end, it's just something you pour a load of water into, and it's slightly cooler.
That's called a fan, Mark.
Yeah. I think I've been diddled. 60 quid for a fan. Yeah, not too happy about that.
So,
Ian, just for anyone who doesn't listen to your show, you cover political stuff on LBC, yep. But also you are a member of the lobby as well. So you obviously keep in touch with politics fairly closely.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting pair of hats to wear in many respects, because I think as distinct from others that sit in the press gallery at the House of Commons, who really have one focus, and that's to report and on occasions give their own slant or spin to what they believe is happening or where they think a certain political story is going. Obviously, with doing a radio show that is phone-in based, you are charged with doing that, but also there's the other hat of trying to enlist other people's comment, try to make it entertaining, try to put a kind of a quirk on it rather than a spin. So as distinct from just doing straight line, if you like, linear current affairs coverage, it does sprawl into other areas, which is good and bad. It also means that, you know, you're neither sort of one thing or the other. So in many respects, that's a good thing, that you can, you know, once in a while you'll find yourself talking about the NHS and waiting lists or something, and then before you realize it, you're talking about road tax, MOT, and what was the funniest thing you ever wore to a fancy dress party. Now, that should be, in one respect, a great, as a broadcaster, you think that's brilliant, you can do both things. But the downside of that is that there is always a danger that you potentially dilute the integrity of one by bringing in the other. I don't think you do, but I know there is a perception sometimes that if you're not all out, all singing, all dancing, 24/7, 100% politics, then somehow you're doing something wrong. I think politics could do with taking itself sometimes less seriously. And if you can put a fun slant on something and look at something from a more of a quirky angle, then I think I'd like to think that's a good thing.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think politics is often too much perceived as a kind of a special thing that needs to be treated with care and respect, and
sure,
and it's separate from other stuff. And actually, really, when it boils down to it, I think politics it affects everyone's lives, and I don't think everyone always appreciates that. And the more accessible that it can be made, I think the better. I think the idea that it's always got to be, you know, highbrow is,
sure,
I don't think that's right.
Well, I think that's true. And, you know, we constantly have that conversation about stories that are only of interest to the Westminster Village. And, you know, often I think that is the down to those in the Westminster Village who make stories deeply uninteresting. I mean, clearly there are stories that are never going to be the first thing that Bob in Arbroath thinks about when he kicks his quilt off the bed in the morning. But nonetheless, you know, there are other stories that I think can just be more interesting if political journalists allowed them to be. But there is that sort of sense that there's a bit of an old boys network, and it is mostly old boys. I mean, you know, thankfully there are clearly females as well that work in political journalism, but there's still that perception that it's a bunch of guys in grey suits. And that isn't just about those that sit in Parliament. That's often about those that report on it as well. And I think that perhaps that image doesn't, in many respects, the image that it is that select group of middle-class, privately educated blokes, and there are as many in the annals of journalism as there are in the corridors of Westminster as well, but it doesn't do itself any favours in that respect. And I think to take itself sometimes not as serious as it currently does would be a good thing. And that doesn't mean that you either have serious observational journalism or you have satire. There is something, I think, in the middle somewhere where you can make the political interview or the political story a little more interesting if you bring it down to something more accessible to the masses. And I think that's where perhaps current affairs coverage has spectacularly failed.
Yeah, we had Isabel Hardman from the Spectator on as a guest a few weeks ago.
Sure.
We were actually talking about this, about, you know, how accessible a lobby is and whether it's sexist and whether it's male dominated. Yep. I mean, her view was it is male dominated, but she said that she had never really been made to feel unwelcome in the. It's been male dominated for so long that it's taking a very, very long time for the demographics within the country to kind of work their way into the lobby, as it were.
Yeah, I don't think there's an inherent problem there. I think this is just part of an evolutionary process that once upon a time it was a job that blokes did, and there were lots of social and economic reasons why that was, and we're now in the process of that sort of changing, and it will change. So I don't think that in itself is a specific issue, but it is nonetheless still interesting that, you know, you can often watch the political interview and there'll be somebody from the cabinet on, there'll be somebody from the shadow cabinet, there'll be the person doing the interview, there might be a guest journo chipping in, and you look and you think what you actually see are four white guys in grey suits, all privately educated, all from, and you sort of wonder, well, I certainly do, coming from a working class background, I wonder who that is aimed at. I wonder how many people feel immune from the process because of what they're looking at. That doesn't mean that if you're privately educated, which I think is a fabulous thing, if your parents were able to afford that privilege, great. But it doesn't mean you're immune from taking part in it. Of course not. That would be as crazy the other way around. But nonetheless, that is the image that we are constantly bombarded with, of people all of the same kind, if you like, the same type. And whether that's an issue of sex or class, it's probably an amalgamation of the two. But certainly I think there's definitely there's a question mark over how current affairs is delivered and whether we'll ever run away from that. And the danger, I think, as well, I mean, it's great that there are more females involved in current affairs coverage, but in the same way that, you know, if you try to get more ethnic minority people involved in a certain profession, then what that's meant to say is ethnic minority people or females that didn't think they had a chance. If you're only getting the middle class, privately educated equivalent of those females or of those ethnic minority groups, then you're spectacularly missing out on the class factor. And I think that's the issue that I feel more strongly about, is that the working class aspect, and there doesn't seem to be a lot of that in mainstream politics, and there's not an awful lot of it, if any at all, in current affairs coverage from the journalistic point of view.
Yeah, I suppose you're right. I mean, I suppose, like you say, the background of most people involved in politics, the media, is generally middle class.
Yep.
I guess maybe, again, it's going to take time for it to work through that. Okay, well, I thought we might talk about the prospects for the three main parties in the coming year or so. So obviously it's currently summer 2013.
Yep.
So maybe if you can start off just by giving us your thoughts on what that will happen with the Conservative Party over about the next year.
Well, obviously the Conservatives have kind of played this like a high stakes game in a casino, and from May 2010, and I think anybody who wants to or can be bothered to be serious about politics has to at least give the coalition one thing, and that is that the plan, whether you want to call it austerity, some say there's not really much austerity at all, whatever you want to call it, they said in May 2010 it was going to be tough, it was going to be really tough. In fact, they were saying it pre-May 2010. Most people, those leadership debates, even said before the election that it was going to be tough. I mean, these cuts and the like didn't just happen as a big surprise. We knew they were coming, and it was quite interesting that prior to them coming in, even I think a Guardian survey had something like 70% of people supporting the notion, because everybody felt quite good at joining in and being sensible. And yes, we have to be, you know, realistic with the books, etc. It was only when they sort of came in that people started to scratch their head, and the sort of left-wing mafia decided that Armageddon was about to take place and all manner of horrible things were going to happen to individuals. And whether they have or whether they haven't is another issue. The fact, or the point I'm making here, is that the Tories in particular, along with the coalition, said, you know, this was a 5-year plan. Don't judge it on year 1, 2, or 3. Judge it on year 5, when we go back to the ballot box, the first election where we've ever known the date of the next election. So it was a 5-year plan. The Lib Dems could claim the same territory on that. And I think with the Tories, it's down to the economy. It's as simple as that. There are now signs that there is recovery. And it's interesting how that translates very, very quickly. I mean, the opinion polls still favour Labour, but that gap gap is narrowing. And if people feel that a few years of being prudent with the books paid off, unemployment is coming down, and there are signs of a recovery, small as it might be, but better, much better than the European average, almost as good as the global average. America, of course, are, you know, doing slightly better, but they were ahead of the game in the first place. If the economy looks good, then it's, I think, inaccurate to write off the Tories as potentially winning the next election. It'll be down specifically to that. Whatever the you know, Owen Jones and the Len McCluskeys of this world want to tell us, if people feel that the economy is improving and they can see signs of that in the housing market, in the job market, then the Tories are still in with a chance.
Yeah, I mean, when it comes to the Tories, I think we're in interesting territory, because if you actually listen to what George Osborne said in his first budget straight after the 2010 election, and you compare it to what has happened more recently this yep. year, it's pretty hard to argue that we are where he thought we would be. We're actually not. And yet somehow in the most recent statement that he made to the House, which wasn't actually a budget, it was the spending review, wasn't it? His political stock seems to be rising again. Do you find that surprising, given that really there is an argument, and like you say, Owen Jones, Len McCluskey, but even more mainstream Labour and left-wing commentators yes. have a reasonable argument to say we are not where he said we would be 3 years ago?
Well, I don't find anything surprising now, Mark. We live in a world where the government who were the stewards of the last economy, when the entire thing collapsed, even if you want to argue that it was a banking issue and nothing to do with Labour, they were the stewards of the economy. They can't run away from that. And yet, half an hour after they were last in power, the very same people are asking to be re-elected. The city minister is saying, make me the chancellor, and they are ahead in the polls. Now, all the while, you have public opinion that can be, to me, as crazy and as misplaced as that. Nothing would surprise me. And I watch, you know, Osborne's budgets and his autumn statements, his mini budgets, whatever you like to call them. They seem to have a different name every week. And those figures, as you say, they do change. You know, he talks about where we'll be in 2016-17, and they're the numbers to look at. You think, hang on, they're a completely different set of numbers that you gave us on the last one. I do understand things move nicely, but so much of politics, I think, is based on perception rather than detail. If we bothered ourselves with all the detail, then I don't think we'd be voting for any of the three main parties, probably. But we look at what the, to quote that phrase, the pound in our pocket is doing. If there is a sense that things are improving, then I think that people take it at that level rather than the minutiae of what might be buried in the finer detail of George Osborne's autumn statement.
So it seems like your feeling is that if the economy is improving, doing better at the point of the next election, then that is probably the most important thing.
Yeah, I mean, the one thing, I mean, it's been a perfect storm in many respects against the coalition, with lots of things happening. You know, we didn't know there was going to be another European/global recession post 2010. And there really has been. If you look at what's happening in Spain and Greece, just park to one side a second. I mean, they're catastrophic tales. But, you know, if you look at what's happening in France now, even Germany, areas where we always thought there was guaranteed growth, China, you know, slowing down at a rate that nobody quite expected. So there's a lot to be said about how we perceive things. And, you know, I think the Conservatives and the Liberal Democrats came in at a time when everything was almost against them. And I'm not expecting anybody to shed any tears for that. But I mean, who could have predicted that the worst summer and winter, looking at last year, would have had such a catastrophic effect on high street sales, for example? I mean, it almost, you know, the last summer was obliterated in the high street. So that figure wasn't so good. And I think there's a self-compounding philosophy, really. If you put the message out that things are bad, then people are frightened to, you know, banks are frightened to lend, people are scared to spend. But there are signs that that is changing. I think, you know, biggest mortgage approvals in the last 5 years or something, we heard a little while ago. So all the while those kind of stories keep coming up, then I think that perception that things are improving will play well, particularly for the Tories. I feel sorry for the Liberal Democrats in this, because I think they've played a blinder. I think the Liberal Democrats should in many respects go down as the most successful political party of a generation. But because of one policy and one news story and one focus, i.e. tuition fees, there is this rather mad and completely illogical perception that everything they've done has been rotten, when in fact, what is it, 70% of their manifesto is into government. I mean, that's far more than the Tories, and they've done that with 57 MPs. And yet you'd be forgiven for thinking that, you know, this is some rabid party that is set out to damage things. And in fact, they've achieved much of what they said they would, against all the odds.
Well, it's interesting you say that. I mean, obviously, I'm biased because I'm a Dem, but why do you think that that is the case? Because I think you actually make a reasonable argument there. I'm not sure I'd go so far as to say that the Lib Dems are the biggest political success story of the last 25 years.
Yep.
But I don't think most people would agree with that, even in the Lib Dems. But I think most Lib Dems would agree that the party has not had a fair hearing for what it's achieved. I just wondered why you think that has happened. Do you think it's a structural problem? Do you think it's the fact they've never been in power before, so the media doesn't really know how to deal with the coalition?
I think it's a bit of that. I really think everything goes back to tuition fees. And I find it breathtakingly extraordinary to hear members of the Labour Party slaughtering Nick Clegg over the tuition fees argument when, firstly, they were the party that said no more tuition fees. They were the first party to introduce tuition fees for higher education. So how they can even show their face in public on that debate, I've no idea. Plus, of course, Gordon Brown would have happily got into bed with the Lib Dems back in May 2010, and exactly the same deal would have been hammered out on tuition fees. Nick Clegg would have been forced to swallow that particular area of policy, and the same thing would have happened. So quite where this moral high ground comes from the left, or from Labour, I should say, about tuition fees, I've no idea. But I think that was the seed that has really, I mean, it's haunted Nick Clegg, really. And there is this now sort of strange perception that he's propping up the Tories as if he couldn't possibly be there for any other reason. And yet, you know, if you'd put him in coalition with the Labour Party, I think right now, if we'd had the beauty of the time machine, I think we'd be sitting here in exactly the same position. I don't imagine that we'd have massive growth anywhere in particular. I mean, it is extraordinary, isn't it, that just to divert into where Labour have said they would be right now, that given the fact that, you know, I mentioned China a second ago, some of the areas of even parts of India, you look at what's happening all over Europe. And yet, despite the European and even the global downturn, somehow Ed Miliband had a 5-point plan that was going to buck the entire global trend and get us all out of this mess. And yet we are ahead of most of those European countries. But Miliband seems to think, or wants to tell people, that his plan was going to do what no other country on the planet was able to do. I mean, this is hogwash of the highest order. But to go back to perceptions, for some reason, despite the fact that this was the guy writing the speeches for Gordon Brown when he was Chancellor, latterly when he was Prime Minister, etc., this was the man that was the Energy Secretary at a time when they could have done something about rising bills. None of that, all of that seems to be brilliantly forgotten. I mean, it's a very topsy-turvy world we're living in, when a party that could have been in power such a short time ago could have so much of their CV of doom, it almost erased in the minds of certain voters. And not only erased, but many of those voters still coming back saying, oh, we're going to vote Labour. I mean, the NHS is the classic example. I keep banging on about this. How many people would have had to have died in the NHS under a Labour government for people to finally conclude maybe this isn't the party of the NHS after all? And when we've seen just a little while ago, we saw an announcement that, you know, another 13,000 people thought to have died. That doesn't include what happened in Mid-Staffs. It doesn't include what happened in Morecambe, Cumbria, etc. Can you imagine if all of those stories had happened under a Conservative government? We'd be hearing stories from the usual candidates on the left that this was all about privatisation, it was all about a lack of care, it was all about the fact that there was too much emphasis on X, Y and Z and not enough emphasis on patient care. And yet, I'm hearing very little from those on the left about a staggering amount. I mean, we're talking death here. We're not talking about, you know, a few elements of admin going slightly wrong. We're talking about people dying. But the perception, again, still seems to be that Labour are the party of the NHS. And, you know, I think that's another example about how it's all about the perception rather than the details.
Yeah, I mean, I think what you're saying there, if my co-host Emma was on, I think she'd probably challenge you on some of the stuff you've said there. But the point you're making about how the perceptions are and how these issues are covered. I mean, I think if I could boil it down to perhaps something that's a little bit simplistic but might resonate, is Labour are trusted on the NHS and the Tories aren't trusted on the NHS. The Tories are trusted on the economy and Labour isn't really trusted on the economy. And on those kind of broad brush issues, Labour can construct a narrative that seems to chime with people on the NHS because they were the party that was involved in founding it.
Sure.
And I mean, a lot of Labour people have a very, very close emotional association with the NHS. And
sure.
I mean, the Tories kind of lost their economic competence markers during the mid-90s after the ERM debacle. But yep. I think still generally, and certainly after the crash of 2008 and all the problems when obviously Labour had been in for a long time, I think the Tories now do seem to have the mantle of economic competence again, and Labour is trying to get that back. So those things, I mean, this happens on lots of different issues, and those are perhaps just two striking examples. But there just seems to be not enough nuance and analysis within the discussion and the way that these things are covered to take into account the fact that, like you say, if there are problems in the NHS when it was on Labour's watch, what actually are the reasons for that? Rather than have necessarily the mud that gets slung from both sides.
Sure.
And, you know, the same with the economics, because I'm not going to sit here and say it was all Labour's fault in 2008. There were global aspects to it as well. But Labour turn around and say it was all to do with the global factors. And the Tories say it was all to do with Labour. And trying to tease out what the actual reasons are behind these things.
Indeed. I mean, for what it's worth, I think exactly the same thing would have happened in the last 13 years had we had from 1997 to 2010 a Tory government. I think exactly the same thing would have happened. So I'm not making a point here that is specifically pro-Tory, because that's certainly not where I'm coming from. I'm simply saying that, you know, the perception of events is overtakes any kind of detail. Now, yes, it would have been the same had the Tories been in. However, they weren't, and Labour were in. I'm not suggesting the banking crisis was down to the Labour Party, but it is extraordinary that I could have been doing phone-in shows in 2005, scratching my head and constantly asking the question, how can it be that my work experience guy has got 30,000 quid on credit cards? How can that be? You know, the guy's 19 and he's got 30 grand on credit. How can it be that somebody I work with in the office who's on 22,000 a year has just got a £350,000 mortgage? I was spotting that. Why wasn't the Chancellor spotting that? So it might not have been that, you know, you take LIBOR, for example, which, you know, we are told Ed Balls knew nothing about despite being the city minister. I mean, that's extraordinary. He either did or he didn't. And if he didn't, he's a lousy city minister. And if he did, then, you know, frankly, he should be up before the beak answering some pretty serious charges on this. So it's one thing or the other. So, yes, it was. There was a global, clearly a global occurrence that happened. But whoever was in power, I'm afraid, has to shoulder that one. And on this occasion, it was Labour. You know, who was in power when all these people seem to be dropping like flies in NHS wards, again, it was Labour. But you'd still be forgiven for thinking that, you know, Labour are that they are the nice people. They might get it wrong sometimes, but they're ultimately nice people, whereas the Tories are a bunch of characters that don't really care about anybody, couldn't care if anybody dies, and they just make policy to suit their millionaire friends. I mean, it's farcical that government works like that, but there is an absolute perception that it does. And I don't know if you could ever really change that, because, and of course, you compound it by sticking a couple of Etonians at the dispatch box, you know, the only area of life that we're allowed to ridicule as much as we like, you know, and get away with it. We couldn't do that with religion or colour, but we can do a little bit with class. And I find it quite funny. I mean, we always satirise a toff, of course we do, but putting all those elements together does create this narrative that the Conservatives are uncaring, and Labour, whatever their shortcomings, actually do care. And that's the area that I challenge, because I don't really see any difference between the two.
It's quite interesting, actually, as you're talking about that what goes around comes around, because I think you're right. I think that had the Tories been in between 97 and 2010, I think there'd have been very little difference in what happened.
Yep.
And yet, obviously, the Tories can turn around and say, well, it was Labour that we're in and it's your fault and all the rest of it. And actually, exactly the same thing happened regarding the ERM debacle.
Yep.
Labour backed the Tories before 1992 to the hilt about that. they would have done exactly the same as the Tories. In fact, they might have gone in even earlier. And yep. yet, as soon as Black Wednesday happened, suddenly it was all, well, the Tories...
Nothing to do with
look,
us, Gov.
Exactly, yeah. Look how terrible the Tories have been. Yeah. So I suppose it was ever thus when it comes to that sort of thing. And just, obviously, you've mentioned Labour a few times, but what do you think Labour's prospects are? Do you think that actually they have a decent shot over the next year or two,
Yes, I do. I think they have a decent shot because they're not the Tories. And I still think, despite the everything that I've just said, and I think if we were standing there in a court of law and I were to throw just the small amount of evidence that I've put to you in the last 15 minutes, I think I would win that case as a clear-cut reason why Labour should not be back in office. However, the fact that they're not the Tories, the fact that there is this perception that the Tories are cutting left, right and centre and doing all sorts of horrible things to the health service, most of which is untrue. The bits that are true were already happening and will continue to happen. The example I always give to people is, look, if you don't want, you know, if you really do believe that there's we're about to privatise the entire NHS, just vote for Labour in 2015 and see how much of the NHS bill gets eradicated. See how many of Virgin's private clinics are closed down if Labour gets... The answer is none of them will be. And the privatised element of the NHS, which began really in earnest under Andy Burnham and the last government, will simply continue. There will be no different, but people will still choose to see it differently. You can see them almost saying, well, they had no choice. They had to carry it on because the Tories had written a contract and blah, blah, blah. No, if you really want to stand by your words, then you will do what people, or you will, in the case of the NHS, you will get rid of all these elements that you think are so evil that were put in place by the Tories. But in fact, the reality is that won't happen, Mark. And come 2015, if Labour do get into power, the NHS bill may be reworded, it might be given a different name, but it will continue in exactly the same vein.
Interesting. Okay, well, maybe if we just move on to, I wanted to also talk about the Euro elections for 2014, because they seem to have become quite a pivotal focus for people.
Sure.
Not least because of the rise of UKIP. UKIP have been on the rise for quite a long time now, probably for several yep. years. But earlier this year, it seemed to reach a crescendo with, frankly, amazing performance in the local elections. I think they got 23% of the vote. Actually, they didn't get anything like as many councillors as they should have got given that. But, you know, that's because of the way councillors are elected in this country. But they certainly got well over 100. Do you think that, well, the first question is, do you think that the Euro elections matter very much as regards domestic policy? Obviously, they matter as regards who we return to the European Parliament, but they're never really filtered through that prism. They're usually filtered through what yes. does this mean for the domestic parties and the domestic leaders. Do you think that the result of that really matters for domestic politics?
I think the headline matters. Again, I think what's likely to happen is that UKIP will do as well as they have done in the past, maybe a little better.
Do you think they might actually win it, as in be the largest party?
I'm not sure about that. I still think there are, you know, whatever we say about UKIP, whatever we say about floating Tory voters who are, you know, keen to find what some consider to be true conservatism, and they believe that that's alive and well in the UK Independence Party, I still think there are pockets of people who just simply don't leave that party that they've followed forever. And whether they'll be the main party, I would doubt it. I don't think that's the case, in the same way as that I would doubt that they're likely to return an MP into power in Westminster in 2015. So I don't think that's going to happen. But I think, again, what will happen, which is more bad news really for the Tories, unless the economy continues to recover, is that there will be that perception, which will give David Cameron that horrible dilemma where he's got to decide, you know, do I appease some backbenchers, the Philip Davises of this world, and start appearing to be a little more anti-European and right-wing? I mean, David Cameron is no more anti-European, really, than Ed Miliband's anti-European. I mean, they're all pretty much, despite, again, popular mythology, I think they're all pretty much centrist parties. I remember once talking to a professor of politics, a global professor of global politics. This guy was an expert in where different parties sit on the spectrum, left wing, right wing, somewhere in the middle, etc. And he was, you know, pointing out how certain rabid administrations in South America and different parts of Africa, etc., are extremely right or extremely left. And I put to him whether the Conservatives were a right wing party, you know, as in what we consider to be a real right-wing party. He nearly fell off his chair laughing at this idea. Again, the perception is that they are, but the reality is that they aren't. And I think, you know, David Cameron needs to remember that I think they are still a pretty much a centrist party. That's why it was all so close at the last election, because all three parties were at some level singing from a core hymn sheet. However, if UKIP do well next year, then that does pose that same problem again, and we yet again see the Tories fighting over the carcass of those elections and deciding whether they should go more to the right to appease those people who they think are going to disappear to UKIP. I don't think whatever happens in the Euro elections, it will have a bearing on the 2015 election, but it will have a bearing on the narrative leading up to it.
So, because Cameron has already thrown quite a lot of red meat to his ravenous backbenchers. I mean, he's said that there will be an EU referendum in 2017. I know party leaders have promised this sort of thing before in the past, and then it hasn't come to pass. But I cannot see how it is possible for him to not follow through on that promise if he is prime minister after 2015. So now there is an argument for saying, and some people in Labour, Keith Vaz particularly, and others have been agitating for Labour to actually say, look, you know what, let's have a referendum before that. Let's have a referendum before or at the same time as the 2015 general election, which I don't quite understand why Miliband hasn't done that, because that would that would put the Tories in a kind of excruciating position.
Totally.
I mean, do you think this referendum actually will happen? So I guess the question is, either do you think that David Cameron will be in a position to deliver it, or do you think one or more of the other parties will pledge it and therefore it will happen?
I think it will happen. I think it's got to happen. I don't think it can be any moment. All parties have previously pledged one of these things. I think this is, we're in different territory here. But what I think is likely is that, let's assume the Tories do get an overall majority and they are in power after 2015 and they have this election. Obviously, everything's down to the question that you ask. I mean, the in-out, I mean, it's very quite loose language, really. We'll pledge an in-out referendum.
Yeah.
I mean, what do they actually mean by that? Is the question going to say, are you in or are you out? Would it be as simple as that? Will there be something that is a little more detailed in that? Will the question be loaded to throw it in another direction? You know, will we be better off in or better off out? If that's the question. So whatever the question is, clearly, I mean, we've seen this with the Scottish independence question. You know, I think Alex Salmond wanted something like, you know, do you think Scotland is the best country in the world and everybody in it is utterly brilliant and deserves a massive pay rise? If you think that, then vote to keep us out of the union. But if you load the question in a certain way, people are always going to vote in a certain way. And I wonder whether that's the kind of territory we'll be in 2017.
Yeah. Do you think, though, because obviously people who are anti-EU and want out, they must think that they can win this referendum. Otherwise, they wouldn't have been agitating for it for the last 20 years. So do you think they're right? Do you think they can win? Because my feeling is that in this country, the status quo has such an inbuilt advantage when it comes to referenda, because whoever's running the campaign that wants to change things has to convince people that it's not that scary. I mean, we saw this with the AV referendum, you know, the no campaign just scared the bejesus out of anyone who was thinking of voting yes.
Yeah.
And they're going to be in exactly the same position, but the shoe's going to be on the other foot, because probably most people who didn't want AV are the people who do want to come out of the EU. And do you agree with the premise that this country is kind of conservative with a small C, and any referendum that's trying to change anything? So actually, maybe we'll include the Scottish independence one here as well, because I wanted to talk about that too. Do you think either of those referendums are winnable by the side that wants to massively change things?
I think they, as you say, or as you hint within that question, they're the ones that have the uphill struggle in the debate. I think what's interesting is that, looking, for example, at Twitter, I know Twitter isn't the oracle on everything, but some of the sort of, if you like, I hate to stereotype, but the archetypal sort of cab driver view of things. And I've spoken to a couple of cabbies that usually say, you know, let's get out of Europe. This is a waste of money. What we do in there, it costs us X amount of million pounds a day. It's an utter cartel of people who have all manner of interest, self-interests within it. They haven't audited the books at all since, you know, Lord knows when, and therefore we must get out. But even some of those guys are now saying, actually, would we be better off out? Because that's quite a big old risk to take us completely out of a European trading bloc. Whatever the craziness of the wrong shaped bananas or the wrong type of olive oil and all that guff that we hear about, silly rules and regulations that come from Europe, and there are many, and many of them aren't all just fabricated Daily Mail front pages. Some of them are actually real and quite infuriating. But I think when it comes to the serious question that in a global economy where everything is interlinked, where the world is a very different place from it was even 10 years ago, do we want to somehow, within that, be the only country on the planet that is suggesting that we are going to remove ourselves from the European Union and go it totally alone? And I think when people are really faced with the severity of that question, even saying it now and thinking about it and saying it out loud, makes me think, wow, can you imagine? I mean, even if you look at Australia, you know, Australia has their own business bloc that they trade within. The Americas do, you know, look at Canada, parts of South America, North America, etc. They do as well. The idea that we are, I'm not saying it couldn't work, but man, what a risk that would be for anybody to take. From tomorrow, we go it alone. And of course, the caveat to all of this is that I'm pretty sure that if there was a vote to come out, the next part of that question is when. So is it going to be a case of, okay, you voted to come out and we will enact the results of that poll in 2030. So we're going to have another 13 years of being in before we come out. And then by the time we get to that stage, different governments would have taken over and we may find there's another referendum. So it's just not as straightforward as it's an in-out referendum, which makes it look as if we're going to have a vote on the Tuesday and we'll all be out on the Wednesday. I simply can't see that happening.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing that you say there about the kind of London cabbie test. Reminds me a little bit of the old grey whistle test, that old BBC Two programme that was named,
yes,
because I don't know if you're aware of this, that
recording
studio in New York, and whenever they'd done a session, they come out, and if the old man who you know was the commissioner on the door, if he was whistling the tune that's just been playing, then that was a good indication it was going to be a hit. A similar thing here, if the cabbies, that potentially the kind of demographic that you think of as perhaps quite reactionary, if even they're taking a few steps back and thinking, oh, hang on a minute, then I think that is probably a good indication this is a harder battle to win than I think some of the arch Eurosceptics might think.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, if you look at, I mean, clearly the media likes to focus on those anti-European conservatives. But if you look at quite a lot of the new breed of Tories that are there today, sort of Anna Soubrys, those kind of characters, then, you know, the idea that those people all think we should get out of Europe is a nonsense. You know, the reality is that the Conservatives are the party that put us into Europe. They are, despite popular mythology, at their core, a pro-European party. And yet you'd be forgiven for thinking it was the other way around. They've never, ever, there's never been a, even under Thatcherism, you know, Thatcher argued a pro-European stance in a very different way, maybe, when she, you know, the famous no, no, no speech. But nonetheless, she wasn't saying we don't deal with Europe, we don't have an arrangement with Europe. They've always had, even amidst the cynics, a contingent that still wants to continue having a European system in place. It's just down to how you name it and who runs it, really. So I think the conservative anti-Europeans would struggle, really struggle, to make their argument for without a great deal of scaremongering to make their argument. In the same way as, you know, it's been proven that UKIP have been unable in 10 years to make that argument. That's why they've got nobody in Westminster.
Okay. I thought just in the last few minutes we might move on and talk about just a last couple of issues. I'm not sure if you can describe Boris as an issue, but I just wanted to cover Boris because obviously he's been bigged up by all sections of the media, really, because they like him. He's good copy. He gives good quote. And he now is a serious player. I mean, I couldn't believe that the Tories put him up to be London Mayor back in 2008 originally, wasn't it? And obviously he is now Mayor, and he's talked about as a serious potential future Tory leader and potential Prime Minister. Do you think that'll ever happen?
I don't think he will ever become Prime Minister, but I do think he will probably try to become Prime Minister. If you go to Nick Clegg's constituency in Sheffield and look at some of the few remaining steelworks that are there, and find the biggest furnace that burns brightly, well, the one that sits in Boris's tummy is greater than any furnace you will see burning anywhere in the UK when it comes to ambition. Because, you know, that guy, despite the bluster and the, oh gosh, look at me, cripes image, you know, is a walking, talking piece of ambition that simply wants the top job. I mean, it's in his blood, it's in his DNA. He's not an idiot, he's an incredibly clever guy. It's amazing that anybody actually still thinks he's an idiot. Clearly, you know, he's not. I just don't think when push comes to shove, I think he's a clunky character. He is fun. I think he's a great choice for the Mayor of London, of which I see about 80% of that job being PR. And in that respect, he's good. People like him, you know, stick him on the streets of Brixton or stick him on the streets of Chelsea. And, you know, bar the odd dissenter, he usually gets a good old welcome, a bit of a cheer. All right, but, you know, even his name's Boris. You know, very few politicians. Ken, you could sort of get, you know, Boris and Ken. How many politicians do we only talk about in the, you know, in the first name? And some have that, and he does, and he's one of them. So if David Cameron fails to deliver in 2015. Darn right, he'll go for a seat and want to lead the Conservative Party. Whether that means that he'll ever become the Prime Minister, I think that's a very slim chance.
Yeah, I mean, what I find difficult to countenance is the idea that he... So I can believe that he would... He, if he wants a seat in Westminster, he'll get a seat in Westminster, because one of his mates will stand aside.
Of course they will.
Give him a good run and he'll get a safe seat. And there's no problem there. But the timing... I can't see how he could do that before 2016, certainly 2015.
Mm.
And there not be such a massive focus on what's he doing? Why is he going into Parliament?
Yep.
Is he planning to challenge Dave? And just the massive distraction that would cause.
Of course.
And also, he would then appear to be completely disloyal if he was doing that, no matter what his protestations were. So I can't see a roadmap before then. So that leaves us with 2016, let's say, after the 2015 election and after his mayoral term is up, or when it's nearly up, then a by-election could be manufactured somewhere. He could get dropped into Westminster. But by then, the Tories will probably have chosen another leader. So the timing on that isn't even clear as to whether he could be the next Tory leader. But even if he was the next Tory leader, I can't see Boris putting in the groundwork, the spade work that a leader of the opposition would have to do for 2, 3, 4 years, however long it is, that long march to get to the position where he could then fight and become Prime Minister. I just can't see that happening. I think in a short burst campaign like we've seen for the mayoralty, a few months, I think he can sustain it. But
I also don't think, I might be in a minority on this one, Mark, but I don't think he's very good on television. I mean, everybody talks about, you know, what a, you know, great raconteur he is, and he's always got a funny line. But when you put him in a serious debate, this is nothing to do with intelligence, because it doesn't work like that. But in terms of being a televisual character that is persuasive within a debate, in the same way that, you know, you would have on the right, for example, of the Conservatives, somebody like David Davis, who, of course, lost out to Cameron for leader of the Conservative Party. David Davis is a great television performer. He always looks good. He's very slick. He appears to be very normal. Boris doesn't. You know, Boris is a bumbling, mumbling sort of character. And I think when it comes to being taken really, I mean, at the moment, that's kind of all right, because it plays into the role that he currently has. And although as Mayor of London, I'm sure, is a very serious gig, but in the grander scale of things, I think people don't really perceive it as that. Put him there as a man who wants to be Prime Minister. Stick him in front of the Andrew Marrs and the like. And, you know, we've seen how we did the famous sort of Eddie Mayer interview, which I thought, you know, I actually felt sorry for Boris. Eddie Mayer was appalling on that. You know, if Leveson had been looking at television performances, Eddie Mayer would be doing 6 months in jail right now for just for doing the misplaced interview. However, Boris just doesn't perform very well in those kind of areas. So I think he'll be rumbled, not because he's a Conservative. I think he'll be rumbled because he's just not very... So regardless of what happens, if he does find himself in the position, which, as you say, would be difficult to find himself in, but if he does, I just don't see him pulling it off. And that's assuming that nobody else is around that looks as persuasive, or nobody, whoever's in power for Labour, if they're the government of the day, isn't doing well. I just don't think that when push comes to shove, Boris Johnson plays out very well on TV.
Very controversial view, because that seems to be one of the things that he's most noted for.
You know,
he first got really famous because of several appearances on Have I Got News For You, didn't he?
Well, that says it all, really. I mean, that's exactly where, you know, we laugh at the guy because he is, you know, he doesn't always toe the party line. He can say funny things. I don't doubt that he could negotiate with Obama or Putin probably better than all of our current leaders can, intellectually speaking. But that's only part of the gig. And rightly or wrongly, you know, we live in a time where everything is scrutinized via the conduit of your TV appearances. And I think if you put Boris in front of, for example, a leadership debate, and when we had the Mayor of London debates, I thought he behaved appallingly. He dodges questions, he mumbles, he looks indecisive. I don't think you come away with the impression you've got, you come away with the idea that you've sort of just had 45 minutes of vaguely entertaining stand-up, but do you know where you really stand for? They had the Mayor of London debate just a month or so ago with LBC. He was challenged on quite a lot, particularly the firefighters in London and what he was doing there in terms of closing fire stations. And it was just a diatribe of nonsense, really. I have no idea what he meant or what he was trying to say afterwards. But and you're sort of you remember, oh, yeah, he did that funny joke about this or that funny joke about that. But actually, when it comes to the substance, I'm sure he's got it there, but his inability to impart that to the electorate, I think, is actually his downfall, which is funny when he's the Mayor of London. Most of the rest of the country can look at it and say, oh, he's that funny guy that has that little job down in London. But put him as the Prime Minister, regardless of how capable he is behind the scenes. And, you know, if you've had the kind of jobs he has, and you've been the European editor for The Telegraph, and you've had the kind of education, clearly he can do all of that. But whether that comes across on TV, I think he will be rumbled by the TV camera.
Okay, just before we wrap up, just wanted to focus a little bit on 2015. We've kind of alluded to it a few times during our discussion, but what do you actually think will happen in 2015?
Wow, it's a good question. I mean,
if you had to put your money on it, who do you think is going to be the largest party? Do you think there'll be an overall majority, or will it be a coalition?
No, I don't think there will be. The temptation, of course, up until recently was to talk about this Lib-Lab pact. It's funny how you have to use the word pact, isn't it, when you say Lib-Lab? We don't really use that anywhere else but Lib-Lab pact. That's the sort of seductive narrative at the moment. However, the more I think about it, and I don't suppose they would ever deliberately try and engineer this, we could well find ourselves in a position where we have a similar result as in 2010. It might be that the electorate at the end of it all think, well, it's been a funny old couple of years. And in fact, if you look back at, you know, the era we're in now, if you listen to some of those, you know, the Christine Blowers and the Len McCluskeys, you know, you'd be forgiven for thinking that we're living in Dickensian Britain, where people are standing on street corners warming their hands over burning barrels because everybody is homeless and nobody has a job. You know, we have pretty much, you know, the same employment rate. We have more people in jobs than ever before. We have pretty much the same. If you tick the boxes when it comes to employment and the like, it's pretty much the same as it has been for the last 5 years. The perception has changed, and that's back to where we started, really. What people feel are rising food prices and rising energy prices and rising petrol prices. And many people mistake that as government policy. But either way, some people do feel the pinch because of that. And I think that's the only area now that Ed Miliband can really exploit, that in the hope of selling this myth that somehow everybody throughout the land is completely skint. I mean, try and book a holiday, try and go to the cinema, try and go to a pub for a Sunday lunch. All those places, wherever you go in the country, it's not a London thing, are all as busy as they pretty much were. Nothing much has changed, really. One or two people are feeling the pinch more than they were, and I don't think much has actually altered. So in that respect, it could be that the electorate look at what's happened and say, actually, we're going to vote as we did last time around. And that would deliver, of course, a coalition with the Tories and Labour once again, which, you know, in the grander scale of coalitions, I don't think has worked too badly at all. I think Lib Dems have been brilliant at putting the handbrake on the excesses of Tory policy. And I think the Tories have been great at applying a reality check at times to the Lib Dems. And in many respects, I think it's sort of worked out kind of okay. It's not been perfect, but show me a government that is perfect. I think we expect perfection. We expect this, you know, this sort of seamless ride through an administration where nothing ever goes wrong. But if you view it through the prism of controversy, through the prism of a coalition, view it through the prism of a downturn, view it through the prism of a global recession, then things will always look worse than they actually are. But in fact, I think when we come to 2015, we'll be pretty much in the same place as we were sort of 4 or 5, 6 years ago. Nothing much has changed. We're living in challenging times, and that's probably going to be the case for a decade. And I think perhaps the electorate may not go for the Labour line any longer, because they'll see that the economy has turned around a bit, and perhaps they just want to retain the status quo.
Do you think that all three current party leaders will be in place in 2015 by the election as well? Or do you think there's a chance that one of them could go?
Well, the folk, I mean, it is interesting, isn't it, how this changes around? Because, you know, in the first year of Ed Miliband being leader of the Labour Party, every headline said this guy's got to go, he's awful, he's horrendous. And then there was a change around. And now that change around didn't happen because there was any announcement of policy. Nothing changes, there was no big speeches. He did nothing, really, but allow the perception again to grow that the economy was in a bad way. And therefore, because he's not the Conservatives or he's not the Liberal Democrats, we must vote for good old Ed because he's on our side. Forget the fact that he was running the game up until 2010. Forget the fact that he was writing the speeches. His star rose without him making a single policy announcement. So that's how quick things can change, and that's how oddly things can change. So he didn't have to do anything at all in order to find himself not just safe as the Labour leader, but clearly the man who's going to take them into the next election. So his position is safe. The focus has since been, and there's one or two rumblings about a challenge to David Cameron. That's not going to happen, not from the corner of the Elephant and Castle. It's not anyway. But Nick Clegg, of course, is now the one that some are saying, actually, if they change the leader, if you put somebody else in charge, maybe Vince makes more noises about being in bed with the Labour Party than anybody else. If you were to do that, people will see what's happening. They'll vote Labour and the Lib Dems will feel appeased because Vince will say that education policy about tuition fees had nothing to do with me, Governor. And again, people will forget the detail and go with the headline. That's the most likely. But actually, I don't even think, Mark, that's going to happen. I think we will go into 2015 with all leaders in place. I don't think there's going to be a leadership debate as there was before. I can't see how that can happen. And there's a slim chance that the Conservatives can win it. Secondly, I think, based on current economic forecasts, we'll have another Conservative Liberal pact. There you go. I use the word pact in another place.
Okay. An interesting little thing that I noticed a week or so ago is that if the three current leaders remain in place until 2015, then that will be the most stable that the leadership of the three main parties has been since 1975.
Interesting.
I do find that interesting because given how unstable the perception of politics is at the moment and how, you know, austerity and, you know, how polarizing that whole process is, and yet the party leaders will probably, because I agree with you, I don't think any party leader is going to go between now and 2015. They'll have all been in place for almost 5 years at that point, which, is unprecedented in 40 years of leadership changes. OK, well, it's been great to have you on today, Ian. Thank you very much for your time.
Pleasure, Mark. It's been great.
And also, I forgot to mention at the start that you also do your own podcast. Do you want to give it a quick plug?
Yeah, we do. I mean, it could not be more different to everything we're talking about now. It's
maybe that's why I forgot to mention it.
Yeah, it's called Ian Collins Wants a Word. It's essentially me and producer Sideshow Kev chewing the fat about stuff. Once in a while, the odd rant about politics, but mostly it's just the stuff that happens in life.
But I can heartily recommend it. It's certainly good for listening to on the tube for, you know, a bit of downtime. So good stuff. Okay. And I'd also like to thank Audioboo, who very kindly hosts this podcast for us on the internet. And I'd like to thank Kevin McLeod at incomputech.com for our theme music. And we'll be back soon.